from WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington. Welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, how did the District of Columbia apparently manage to botch the Zika testing that it was doing? It turns out now that they made several mistakes among 400 tests for the Zika virus, including for nearly 300 women who may have been mistakenly told that they did not have this mosquito-borne viral infection. Who caught the mistakes and how were they made?
It's one of the most interesting aspects of the story is that Anthony Tran was hired by the city's forensics office last year, and he was going over the statistics, and he saw that 409 secondary Zika tests had been taken and that all of them were negative. And he said that just seems statistically not probable. And so they started rechecking, and they discovered that, in fact, the test had been administered with a mathematical error. And Lord knows I am not going to try to describe what that mathematical error is. But the good news is that all the tests had been sent to the CDC in Atlanta and other places, other licensed places. We're not showing there, too. I mean, you just imagine if you're a pregnant woman and you have the test, and then you're told, no, you don't have any issues. These are all people who travel to Florida and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then to have someone call you back and say, oh, I'm sorry, we've got news for you.
Made a mistake.
So there has not been any horrendous results of this. The horrendous result so far is that there was this massive error in the forensics office.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Nancy Navarro. She's a member of the Montgomery County Council. She's a Democrat representing District 4. Joining us in studio now is Mark Herring. He is the Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Mark Herring, thank you for joining us.
Well, it's great to be back in the studio, Kojo.
If you have questions or comments for the Attorney General, call us at 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Email to kojo@wamu.org or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream or make a comment or ask a question there, too. Tom and Mark Herring, are you aware that Arlington County has said that it's not interested in a gondola connecting Georgetown with Arlington County, that it has more important transportation priorities? What could possibly be more important than a gondola?
Well, apparently lots of things. But, you know, this is an interesting proposal by the Georgetown Business Improvement District that wants more people to come in. There's no subway there, and so they want the bridge. The Key Bridge is heavily used. I think it's been like 50,000 people and then X number of
cars per day.
Vehicles.
And then there are busiest sidewalks.
Busiest sidewalks in the county, and then there are cyclists. But the county did spend $35,000 on a review, and then they said, no, it's not going to do it. It would be kind of interesting. I don't know how architecturally you'd put it in. The Key Bridge is so dramatic itself, I'm not sure what a gondola would have done. I actually stood in one of the gondolas, and it was fairly crowded, I thought. But it's only a couple of minutes' ride. So they said they don't want to go forward. Joe Sternleap, who runs the Georgetown Business Improvement District, tells me that they're still going to go forward with it, and they can see how they can make it work and economically make it work, that they still want to do it.
So was it a model of the gondola?
They actually had a full-size gondola cabin down at the Wilson Building, the city hall. And I climbed up on the truck and went inside to see what it was like. I felt like I was about to go skiing or something.
Well, we will have to see what happens with that. Mark Herring, earlier this week, a federal judge granted Virginia's request for a preliminary injunction against President Trump's travel ban. That case against the orders being litigated by your office. The ban was already on hold based on another court ruling, and the injunction in Virginia only applies to Virginia. Please explain what it all means and why you're fighting this federal executive order at the state level.
Well, thank you. And it was an incredible ruling from the federal district court in Alexandria. And while there had been a temporary restraining order nationwide because of the Washington case, it was nevertheless really important because this was a preliminary injunction that would last all the way until a trial could be held. And at this stage, it also went deeply into the facts, and the analysis also pointed to illegal religious discrimination as the basis for the president's immigration ban, which is very, very significant for a number of reasons. I think this case and the decision represents a check on one of the most extreme claims of executive power that we've seen in a long time. The case comes out of course, the immigration ban, and the day after the ban went into effect, I joined the governor at Dulles Airport and saw, literally, it was chaos. On the one hand, uplifting in the sense that a lot of people had come spontaneously to show support for immigration and to welcome people who are coming into the country, but also frightening. And a woman from, I believe, Iran, when she heard who I was, kind of pushed through the crowd, grabbed me by the coat and said, "Please help me. They have my 5-year-old son and won't tell me anything." And it was several hours before they were reunited. And so that's when I felt I needed to take action. A lot of people were being harmed. Families were being separated. Students, we had a couple of university students from Virginia who were trapped overseas. One was visiting family and stuck in Istanbul, Turkey, and couldn't get back in, a senior from George Mason University. Faculty, researchers were unable to, were afraid to leave the country for fear they wouldn't be able to come back in. And so Virginians were being harmed, and so I joined a case that had been filed. The judge allowed us to come into the case, recognizing the harm that we were facing, and agreed with our arguments. I saw from the very beginning when that ban came out on that Friday evening that this was the Muslim ban that the president had talked about during the campaign. And the judge saw it that way, too.
Who was the initial what was the initial organization that filed the case that you joined?
A couple of individuals from Yemen, the Aziz brothers. And, you know, one of the fascinating things about this, a cadre of volunteer lawyers showed up at the airport. And one lawyer, and I'm not sure if he was the volunteer lawyer or the family had contacted him, but he represented the Aziz brothers. And had gotten an injunction, a temporary restraining order, in that first night. And then we heard reports Saturday night into Sunday morning and early afternoon that the federal agents were not were disobeying the court's order, which was deeply troubling. If that were true, would represent a complete breakdown in the rule of law. And that's when Virginia entered the case.
How does this differ from the case in the Ninth Circuit that Minnesota and Washington State filed?
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Thank you.
All of this, first of all, happened very, very quickly. These cases were moving very quickly because of the chaos that we saw in airports around the country, LAX in California, Kennedy in New York, and in Dulles. And the case in Washington was a temporary restraining order that was immediately appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals got expedited briefing and hearing and issued its decision, and it focused on procedural due process. And the court there focused on green card holders and visa holders having some procedural rights. If the government is going to rescind those, there needs to be some hearing given and some due process. What makes the Virginia case different? Number one, there's a factual record, unlike in Washington, because we were already at the preliminary injunction stage. And there was a mountain of evidence that showed the real intent behind the administration's ban was animus toward Muslims.
But the president said yesterday that he will announce another executive order next week, which will comply with the court order that halted the first travel ban. Do you think that such a ban can be crafted that does not violate the Constitution?
You know, we'll have to wait and see what it looks like. The first few weeks of this administration, if we've seen anything, it's been really erratic and difficult to predict. I think the decision coming out of the case in Alexandria is going to make it much more difficult. It's one thing to address procedural due process concerns. It's very different if the issue is that the motivation itself for the ban was illegal. And religious discrimination is a violation of our Constitution. It violates one of the core principal values that we as Americans hold deeply. And so it's going to be a little more difficult for the administration to say, oh, okay, we didn't have enough lawyers looking at this the first time around. Let's see if they can paper it better this time, if the motivation for it from the very beginning was to discriminate based on
religion.
A
caller has a technical question about this, so put on your headphones, please, and hear what Nick in Winchester, Virginia is asking about. Nick, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good afternoon. I think Attorney General Herring is eminently qualified to make a distinction between a district judge's, a federal district judge's ruling, which affects federal activity within his district, or even within the district of the appellate court, and when it has a nationwide effect. I can remember rulings by district courts in Texas which put a halt to certain actions by President Obama, but only within that district. And I'm curious as to why this particular judge's ruling has nationwide applicability. That's all.
Mr. Attorney General.
Well, the case in Washington and the Ninth Circuit ruling out there has nationwide effect. And the courts there specifically cited the case coming out of Texas with the previous administration and said when it comes to immigration, it is important to have uniform rules across the country, and for that reason, they were going to maintain the nationwide restraining order in place. The judge in Virginia wanted to craft a remedy that was more narrowly tailored to the harm that Virginia was showing, and in her ruling wanted to make sure that her injunction was not, quote, overly broad. And so hers affects only Virginia residents, Virginia students, Virginia faculty, Virginia workers, and so hers is much more narrowly tailored rather than the broader nationwide ban that was in place in Washington. And I also think, in addition to being an important check on executive power, it's important to know that the evidence that was in front of the court showed that this really was not about national security. The administration offered no support for that contention, and the only evidence, ironically, as the judge mentioned, the evidence in front of the judge was this was undermining national security and put Americans and our armed forces at greater risk of harm.
But
both
there's
at home
a new
abroad.
Challenge now in Virginia. News 4 reporting yesterday that ICE agents surrounded a group of Latino men and arrested six or seven of them across the street from Rising Hope Mission Church on Russell Road in the Alexandria section of Fairfax County. Now Governor Terry McAuliffe says he wants an immediate briefing from the Department of Homeland Security after ICE arrested two of those men. They were near a church shelter, apparently. They were in the church shelter and came out and walked across the street where they were confronted by agents who released one individual and arrested two others. What can the governor or you do about that?
Well, I think the governor was right to ask for information from ICE and the administration about their enforcement policies and what, if any, policies are changing.
Senator Warner also has made that
right request.
Yeah.
And I've been talking with a lot of folks in minority communities. There is a lot of anxiety right now. Actually, more than anxiety. There's a lot of fear right now. And people need to know what the new administration's policies are and if they're different. Our experience has been that it is contrary to public policy, to public safety. It's undermining public safety if our local law enforcement become immigration officers and deportation squads. Because, and as the state's chief legal officer, I work with law enforcement all across the state every single day, and we have fantastic law enforcement, some of the best in the country. They rely on trust within the community in order to help keep it safe. If you've got, if someone is a victim of domestic violence, but they or, you know, she or someone in her household might be undocumented, if the local police are being used as immigration officers, that person's going to be reluctant to step forward and report the crime for fear she or someone in her family may be deported. Or if somebody has information about another crime, a shooting, if they're a witness, but they or someone in their family might be undocumented, they're going to be less willing to step forward and provide the information that could further the investigation and bring the person to justice who needs to be caught and brought to justice. So there's creating a lot of suspicion, and it takes years to build that kind of trust between law enforcement and the community, but only seconds to destroy it.
What do you say to the supporters of President Trump who may be listening, who would say illegal immigration was a core of his campaign for president, and that even though President Obama was criticized for going so aggressively against immigrants who had violated the law, that he's simply doing what he said he would do as a running for president, that you and others are just trying to overturn a policy where he says we're going to minimize the illegal immigration in this country, and they're going to be very aggressive about it. So what do you say to them?
Well, I think it's important to look at resources and resource allocation. If the Congress is not addressing immigration reform in a comprehensive way, if Congress is not providing the resources to deal with this, then where are you going to deploy the limited resources that you have? And in the previous administration, under the Obama administration, and a policy that I supported, it is to focus those resources on criminals, especially violent criminals, and that those are the ones that we should be identifying and bring them to justice, and after they've been brought to justice, deport them, but not break up families that are otherwise following the law, paying taxes, working, and are active in supporting our communities.
Good. This is a political question.
Well, this is the politics hour.
Yes, thank you. I usually say that at least twice during this hour. Over in Maryland, your counterpart, Brian Frosch, has been given the ability to bring legal actions without getting the governor's approval. What is the situation in Virginia in terms of your authority? Do you have to work in concert with the governor? If he were or she were a Republican, would this be going forward? How does that work?
Most states, and Virginia is one, that the attorney general does not have to have the governor's permission or authority.
41 states, according to the Maryland Democrats.
Right. And this is something that is really important for folks to understand, is that when you're the attorney general, you've got a responsibility to protect the communities, protect your constituents in their state. And it's also important to exercise independent legal judgment. Carl Racine is D.C.'s first elected attorney general. I think having a direct election for an attorney general is critical to help provide that kind of independence, because sometimes, I have not experienced it. I've had a really good working relationship with Governor McAuliffe, but I am aware and have been told of other circumstances in other states where sometimes the attorney general you have to step in and say, no, governor, or, you can't do something this way because of the law. And so having that direct election really gives a sense of independence. You want an attorney general who can do that and provide independent legal judgment.
Here now is on another issue, Michael in Gainesville, Virginia. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Coach, and thank you, Attorney General Herring. I've lived in the Commonwealth over 50 years. For 40 years of that, I've used marijuana medically for chronic pain. And my question to you, sir, is, do you see on the horizon any decriminalization if a police officer came in my home, they could put me in jail for 20 years for what I'm doing to assist in my pain. I've tried other medications. I've gone through doctors. This is the best on handling the pain. And my question to you is, what do you see in the future for Virginia regarding that?
Regarding medical marijuana, Mr. Attorney General.
Well, I think we are beginning to see other states move toward decriminalization of marijuana. Sometimes that started with medical marijuana, but has been expanded. And I think we can really learn a lot from the other states' experiences with that. I also think because of the potential for medical uses, and this gets into some federal regulations, I think it's really important for the federal government to make whatever changes they need to in order to do the kinds of testing that really should be done in order to demonstrate the medicinal value and make sure that those who feel that they need it for chronic pain have that opportunity.
The District of Columbia has that. Maryland is considering medical marijuana and picking who's going to grow the plants and make them available.
And we also want to make sure that in the meantime, as we're studying how other states, the experience that other states are having and do the medical testing that's needed, we need to make sure that people are not suffering lifelong consequences from small amounts of marijuana that can lead to a criminal record and,
there could be, Attorney General Sessions like has there are some concerns or fears or hopes, depending on your point of view, that the Attorney General will be more aggressive on states, Colorado and others, because it's still illegal if in the federal law. In the district, it's particularly daunting because if you were to get stoned and you're on D.C. property and you walk out and you walk into the National Mall, which is federal property, or any other number of places, you can be arrested. So it's a chaotic sense. But there's a lot of money to be made in marijuana, as we've seen Colorado and Washington State and other places. I just don't see Virginia anywhere in our lifetimes getting to that point. Marijuana and taxing it.
I think
there are a lot of points that we didn't believe we would get to in our lifetimes that we've gotten to, but that's another story. You're also working on a number of hate crime initiatives. We talked about this on the show a few weeks back. You introduced a package of legislation and launched a website to address what your office says is an increase in incidents. Do we know if there have, in fact, been more incidents, or is it that more incidents are being reported?
Well, there are certainly the more incidents being reported, and I think they're more being reported because it's happening more. And I think the numbers are about a 6% increase nationwide, but over a 20% increase in Virginia, a 67% increase in hate crimes directed toward those who are Muslim. And that's why I came forward and brought legislation forward that would have allowed my office to prosecute hate crimes, as well as bring our state's definition more in line with the federal definition. The reason I did that was, number one, I was seeing the increased incidence of hate crimes in Virginia. I've heard the fears and concerns of many minority communities in Virginia, and I no longer have a lot of confidence that the new administration is going to place a high priority on civil rights and anti-discrimination laws. We in America, including Virginia, have been able to count on the Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division to make sure that our anti-discrimination laws are enforced and to make sure that hate crimes are prosecuted. And I would hope the new administration shares that bipartisan commitment, but I don't have a lot of optimism, which is why I came forward with it. And there's also, I've set up a new website called NoHateVA.com, which is a resource for those who feel vulnerable, and it also helps if anyone thinks that they may have suffered a hate crime or know of someone who has. It tells them how that they can report it.
Does it have to be a physical crime? I'm thinking with social media now, there are people who have been driven to suicide on social media when they've been harassed and threatened. Where does social media play in it? If I were prejudiced against you, and I could say most anything on social media in a tweet or Facebook page. Do those rise to the level of hate crimes, or you just have to, or individual basis of what's said or done?
You know, typically hate crimes involve vandalism to property or assault, a physical assault. Words are protected by the First Amendment and free speech. But I also think it's important for all of us, you know, within the community, within our families, within our neighborhoods, to remind others when they, you know, hear that kind of speech that it has, you know, an impact on people. And, you know, we need to come together as a community. There's so much division. We really need to work together and help bring our communities together.
One quick question. If I were on social media and I called on people essentially to violate the law by attacking places of worship.
As your lawyer, I would advise you not to do that.
No, I would not. Could that possibly fall into the level of a hate crime and inciting violence?
It may depend on the circumstances. Okay. So
don't want to get too. We can go as deep as we want with a lawyer. So let's
quickly
stop
back
right there.
The immigration issue again. Here's David in Leesburg, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes. First off, I just wanted to thank Mark Herring for his service as Attorney General.
Thank you.
I'm very proud of you in Leesburg.
That's my hometown.
Just wondering, yes. I hope Laura's doing well.
Uh-oh.
But the question I have for you is, as I was leaving to go get a haircut, I noticed an AP alert that the administration has or is considering using the National Guard to augment ICE in
11 states.
Finding immigrants, and I was wondering, are we going to actually expect to see National Guard troops in Virginia?
So far, Virginia is not on the list of 11 states that the AP is reporting, and there's been an apparent denial by someone in the White House that this is happening. But we also got an email from Paul in Alexandria who asks, would it be legal for the president to force the National Guard to round up people to find undocumented people? Could you stop him if he tried to do that? Presumably in Virginia.
Well, some of these reports are coming out very quickly and then denied. And I guess one point I would make is there seems to have been the first few weeks of the administration seems to be so dysfunctional. It's kind of hard to know what to believe and what not to believe when things like this come out and the administration is denying it.
Here's the memo that this is being based on.
Okay. But, you know, I think it would probably require the concurrence of the governor, or at least the governor's authorization. Those would get into some emergency powers that I would really need to take a look at before I could get into too much detail.
The Congress in the early 2005 or 7, somewhere in that range, broadened the ability of the president to mobilize the National Guard. In this insurrection, there's several other natural disasters and all of that.
Now, the Virginia Guard was called up in the last few years. I think a couple of thousand of our guardsmen and women were called up to support some border patrol along the Mexican border. But that's a very different thing than going around from community to community asking for people's paperwork.
I've just retweeted the memo that people are saying that this whole flap is based on.
Another area your office is working on is predatory lending, an issue that's long been the subject of legislation and debate in Virginia. You note the biggest new threat may be online lenders. Are they regulated in Virginia at the moment?
You know, there's not a very... When it comes to predatory lending, our laws are not nearly as strong as they should be. And the payday lending, car title lending in Virginia, some of these are charging 200 to 300%
230% interest.
Yeah, it is outrageous. Some people who are finding themselves in necessitous circumstances think they've got a way to get out of them using these types of loans, only to find it's really financial quicksand. And there have been some who have been turning to internet loans, and the message that is really important for people to get out is these are just as dangerous as some of those same kinds of predatory loans. So our office is being as aggressive as we can in going after them, but it would be nice if the legislature would give me some better tools to work with.
We've got time for one more.
Okay, good. Virginia politics. Ralph Northam, you've endorsed running for governor. You decided not to run for governor, but to run for re-election. Tom Perriello has jumped into the race late, raised some money. The Republican Party in Virginia blasted him for him saying that the election of President Trump was essentially equivalent to 9-1-1, 9-11. After some pushback on that, he's apologized for making such a horrendous comparison. But is the party, the Democratic Party, which was going to coast to nominations for all three top officials, now going to have a tough time in the state? What does this mean?
Well, of course, it means there'll be a Democratic primary for a race for governor. And I'm supporting Ralph Northam. He and I have stood shoulder to shoulder on a lot of issues that are important to the future of our Commonwealth, and whether it's been standing up for women's rights and making sure that they continue to have the full access to comprehensive health services that they need and deserve, whether it's been on gun violence, helping to build a new Virginia economy, working with the governor on that. So we've worked together on a lot of issues, and I'm going to continue to support him. But I think in terms of what that means for us as a party in Virginia, like a lot of unexpected things that happen in life, they're both opportunities and they're challenges. I think the opportunities are, it means that Democrats are getting energized earlier. It means that the candidate, whoever our ultimate nominee is going to be, will probably be a much better candidate because they have gone through a nominating contest. They will be battle tested and ready to go. So those are on the upsides. And I think what we have to do is try to minimize the risks that we'll be divided. I hope that we'll be united when the primaries are done and we come together. And hopefully, you know, I'm working as hard as I can to make sure that we have a good field program in place so that when the primaries are over, come June, the field programs from those two campaigns during the nomination process can be folded into a coordinated campaign statewide. It is critically important that we maintain the Democrats win at all three levels, governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general. And I would be remiss if I didn't point out that my name will be on that ballot, too. And so I will need as much help as I can.
Mark Herring is the attorney general for the Commonwealth of Virginia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
We'll shortly be joined by Nancy Navarro. She is a member of the Montgomery County Council. In the meantime, Tom Sherwood. In Maryland, former news anchor and Marriott executive Kathleen Matthews has decided to run for chair of the Maryland Democratic Committee. She lost in the race for Congress to then State Senator Jamie Raskin, now Congressman Jamie Raskin, but obviously she wants to keep herself in politics.
Well, you know, she's been talked about for, you know, maybe running for a county executive in Montgomery County. People talked about her maybe making another congressional race. But she's been traveling. I've talked to several people in Maryland. She's been traveling around the state saying that she would be a full-time party chair. Bruce Poole, who's had the job for the last couple of years, Hagerstown lawyer, has had some criticism, but also he has a law firm that he needs to get involved with. And so she so far appears to be like she may well be appointed. I think it's next month. She may be appointed to this job after March 1st when Mr. Poole steps down, and that she will probably be ratified as the new party chair in May. So the way it looks, there seems to be no other candidate at this moment. But maybe our
we'll have to ask Nancy Navarro who she's supporting. She's a member of the Montgomery County Council. She's a Democrat representing District 4. Who are you boosting for party chair in Maryland?
Well, that's a really great question, and thank you for having me. I've had an opportunity to meet with Kathleen Matthews when, you know, she was running. I mean, she's a really extraordinary person, has an amazing body, you know, of experience. Nonetheless, I'm also hearing from constituents that, you know, would like to see other folks jump in.
Any names?
I don't have a list right now with me, but, you know, social media has been pointing some folks out
who
there.
Who is that? I mean, tell us a name because I haven't seen them. You're not endorsing them. Just say, who have you seen on social media?
Folks have talked about, you know, even people like... you know, executive Leggett, of course, he's in office right now, so he can't do that.
He's done that
already.
Yeah,
he's done it before. You know, other elected officials who may be in the mix. But I think that she is the front runner, and I honestly believe that she will do an extraordinary job. I think that we'll be in good hands with her.
If you have questions or comments for Nancy Navarro, call now, 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org. Tweet us at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Join the conversation there. Immigrants around the country went on strike yesterday, and a number of restaurants in our region closed in solidarity with their workers. How did the strike play out in Montgomery County, and do you think it was effective?
It was really amazing to see some photographs that were posted on social media, actually, in Wheaton. It was pretty much like a ghost town, the downtown area of Wheaton. Somebody also mentioned that even the food court at Westfield Wheaton Mall was pretty much empty.
It's not just people working, but people just not participating.
People not participating in solidarity. So I think it was, you know, pretty widespread. I mean, considering that this was something very organic that occurred. And I think in reality, it's to send a message. And in my opinion, I think it's been effective. A lot of people, I think, underestimate not just, you know, immigrants, but obviously families and et cetera, and the work that they do. So I think it was a very nice symbolic gesture.
The chief financial officer of the District of Columbia put out some information. Said of the 829,000 people who have jobs in the District of Columbia, 26% of them are immigrants. I don't know what the numbers are in Montgomery County. Maybe you don't know either. But it's not just in the service industry, but it's across the board, whether they're academics, carpenters, all type.
Absolutely. I don't have the breakdown, but, you know, we do know that in Montgomery County, approximately, you know, over 30% actually of the population identifies as immigrants. And so you can just see that we're talking about, you know, the mainstream, really, of our community. And I think this is why this whole entire situation right now with all this uncertainty has been so difficult in our county.
You know, the administration and its supporters say they have no problem with legal immigrants. Their only problem is with undocumented immigrants, to which you say what?
Well, it's a long story. You know, I believe that we've already had a lot of conversations about the failure to establish a immigration reform, that the federal government has not taken that up. And I do understand you know, the opinions out there. But the reality is that a lot of these people are looking they're either fleeing violence or they're looking for better economic opportunities. And they've been here for a very long time contributing. And so if there were to be an immigration reform process, many, many people would, the first thing they would want to do is to become documented. But there's also the aftermath of families that are mixed status and the chaos that that creates, especially in communities like Montgomery County. We have to remember that in this region, right, the largest surge of immigrants in recent history was from the 1980s. And so we're talking about 30 years where people have established roots in this area, you know, have mortgages, have jobs, you know, second, third generation. So the anxiety and the destabilization that's going to occur in these communities, it's really an issue. And for local leaders, we have to try to anticipate and figure out how we're going to deal with this kind of aftermath because, you know, our school system will be affected, our colleges, I mean, every single aspect of county government will have some type of impact.
Casa de Maryland is Mr. Torres, I believe, is ahead, wants the state to pass a law that will essentially make it a sanctuary state, that the local officials, state officials, won't participate in immigration efforts and turning people over who are arrested or brought up on civil charges of any type. Some people, Ike Leggett, among others, are saying that we don't really necessarily need a state law on that. That could just invite federal retaliation and loss of federal funds. But, you know, the ICE is certainly, immigration is certainly continuing the arrest of people. There's a big story in Virginia that News 4 broke this week. They didn't go into the church, but they stood across from the church, and as people came out, they rounded them up. So that's a lot of anxiety.
There certainly is. And, you know, in Montgomery County, we do have certain policies in place where we do look at priority one and two, which really gets to that point that many people bring up about keeping our community safe. And so we understand, you know, if you break the law and you're a criminal, you need to go. But the concern has been in the past, especially when Secure Communities was implemented, how there wasn't a real understanding. So then you would go after, you know, the mom that's seeking protection from domestic violence or somebody that perhaps ran a stop sign. And so these are the issues that we're trying to address right now. And so at the state level, you know, there is the Trust Act that's been proposed. My colleagues and I are very carefully looking at this. We would like to see some amendments that would conform with the policies that the county has in place, because I think that, again, gets to the point of making sure that criminals are weeded out. And I must also remind us that, you know, some of these criminals tend to target these same communities. And so there's no question and no debate in that respect. But at the same time, we want to make sure that, you know, there is a sense that our residents feel protected and that they will send their children to school, that they would seek assistance from 911, and they would collaborate with our police officers. I mean, you know, building that trust is not easy. And right now, that's a big risk.
Well, you mentioned the state level. Montgomery County had declared itself a sanctuary county, but Governor Larry Hogan, when he took office, announced that Maryland would cooperate with federal immigration officials. And as we saw, ICE officials last week stepped up enforcement in several cities that had specifically declared themselves sanctuary cities. Austin, Texas, Los Angeles. Is a sanctuary designation really more symbolic now than anything else?
I believe so. You know, even in the past, I mean, it's not as if it's been clear cut what that means. Obviously, there's a continuum. And I would say that in Montgomery County, you know, what we put forth has been a very, in my opinion, successful policy, again, where you know that if there's a need to, and we don't actively cooperate in that sense, is, you know, if somebody has been brought in and processed and fingerprinted and there's a hit on ICE, and they, so we will share the release date, for example. But the idea is that we understand that we need to protect our communities. At the same time, when it comes to, you know, families, mothers, et cetera, being targeted, that creates an entire different level of chaos and destabilization in our communities. We're already hearing from our school system of children who are not coming to school, of, you know, a lot of fear, a lot of questions. And so it's a very uncertain time. And
well, Mayor Bowser in the district said she would make available $500,000 in grants to community legal groups and other community organizations to help people fight. That got a lot of negative reaction from some members of Congress, but she said she would do that. Is there anything comparable in Montgomery County?
So a number of things. You know, I approached my colleagues over 2 weeks ago and said, you know, we need to have an internal protocol, some sort of a action plan to make sure that every agency, every department knows how to react, what to do in cases of raids or things of this nature. So that's one piece that we're working on right now. The other is to facilitate the establishment of a legal assistance fund. Our community foundation, the Montgomery County Community Foundation, has been very cooperative, and we're ironing out those details. But that's another important piece, because so many of our residents have asked, you know, how can I help? I want to be able to support many of these organizations who are providing that legal assistance right now, but may not have the capacity because this is obviously expanding. So this is another piece that we're looking at to prepare ourselves to be proactive, because, you know, God forbid something does occur, it's really too late to try to establish protocols
here
and response.
On the phone is Shane Robinson in Annapolis, Maryland, somebody you probably know. Shane Robinson, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Shane.
Shane Robinson is a Montgomery County delegate and chair of the Montgomery House delegation. But go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to, first of all, commend Nancy Navarro for the great work that she's doing on the Trust Act and on immigration in general. And I just wanted to let people know that 23 out of the 24 Montgomery County delegates are co-sponsors of the MD Trust Act, and that regardless of what happens with the positions in the county, that we fully support the immigrant community and are going to fight for them in Annapolis.
Okay. Thank you.
Can we ask what the status of what are the legislation? The session is not going to last much longer. What's the chances of? Has it even been introduced in the House of Delegates yet?
It's been introduced, and there are hearings next week.
On the Trust Act.
And this would actually bar the police from participating and holding persons for ICE. Is that correct?
Well, that's correct. It's a little more complicated than that. I mean, it doesn't go into criminal offenses, but for civil offenses, that's right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Shane, thank you very much for your call. We had a caller who wouldn't stay on the line, who would like to change the subject a little bit. The caller says, I agree with everything Ms. Navarro is saying. However, I have other concerns. When will she take care of her neighbors in Colesville? There's bad traffic, streets in disrepair, etc. What are you doing about this?
Well, I live in Colesville, the issues with the roads, it's really widespread. It's a countywide issue. I mean, we actually added $8 million to the Department of Transportation in this last budget to take care of some of those areas. I actually single-handedly, with the support of my colleagues, made sure that we added lights on New Hampshire Avenue because there was a stretch that was pitch dark and it was a real danger to pedestrians and people using the bus. So that's an enhancement that I'm very proud of. Also, some facade improvements that we're working through in that stretch, especially because the White Oak redevelopment didn't quite include that part of the county. And so we're working on that. But more in terms of a larger vision, the White Oak redevelopment, I think, will bring some enhancements and some amenities to that part of the county. That it's still a great place to live. I live there, lived there for over 14 years. And these are some of the concrete things that we're doing. Also, they have an amazing Greater Colesville Civic Association that I work very closely with.
Your constituents are not done with you. We got an email from Jeff in Germantown. Many of us were glad to see that Nancy Navarro decided to join Roger Berliner in sponsoring the fossil fuel divestment bill, which will require investments in fossil fuel companies to be sold whenever fiduciary duty allows. Roger has always been very vocal about it, but we have not had a chance to hear why Nancy supports this bill.
Well, you know, it's I think that this is a very important step forward for us to be able to identify at least opportunities where we could invest our dollars in. And actually, these are retiree dollars, have those options available for companies that are promoting and supporting environmental stewardship. And so that's why I supported the bill. I mean, obviously, we understand that our fiduciary responsibility is always number one. And I think as we're working through the bill, what it will do is really require the Board of Trustees and investment trustees to develop possible investments. And of course, at the end of the day, people can have an opportunity to choose. But I think it's an important step. It's part of a wider, obviously, a complement of actions that we've taken to promote environmental protection in the county.
I want to ask about child care. I was reading your background and how you got started and wanted to open a child care center when you moved to Wheaton. The regulations were crazy, and so you started an organization that would train people to open child care. We had reports this past week that child care now is more expensive than college. Working families, low and middle income families across the region, across the country, are having trouble with child care.
Yes.
What are the answers to that? I mean, this is a real political question for every jurisdiction.
It truly is, you know.
Do you have early children in the district go preschool? Second or third grade,
right. We haven't reached universal pre-K.
That helps
in Montgomery
a lot for
County.
Parents.
It really does. And actually, we're actively engaged in that conversation right now. We actually had a conversation with New York City to understand how they were able to deploy their universal pre-K. And obviously, this is an issue that's very close to my heart. Worked on it forever. But at the end,
Gray,
you know,
in the district has what that made it was a big issue for him, and now we have it.
Yeah, no, it makes a difference. And at the end of the day, it comes to money, right? And at the end of the day, it comes to, you know, can we develop some dedicated funding streams to be able to at least address pre-K, all-day pre-K for you know, for those who need it most, I mean, at some point you also have to be strategic and maybe start offering some of this, these opportunities to those students, children who are affected by poverty, because those are the children that enter kindergarten already with an achievement gap. And then you have to spend a lot of money remediating. So we're working on all of this right now. Actually, I'm very proud to say that it's a top priority for us on the county council. But again, the real detail is going to be how we get the money to fund it.
You've also been working on raising the minimum wage to $15 by 2020, but the council's legislation was vetoed by County Executive Ike Leggett in January. Will it likely be put forward again?
We're trying. You know, obviously, the goal is to be able to put it forth and have it vetoed again. I mean, we were trying to see whether we can get one other colleague to agree to support it so that we can override the veto. But there hasn't been a consensus on what would be the additional amendments necessary. You know, those of us that sponsored the bill really worked really hard to work collaboratively with the executive to take into consideration his concerns. And I think we put forth a number of amendments that we thought were going to be enough, but unfortunately it fell short. And now it just depends on, you know, whether we could pick up another vote or whether we can agree on what would be some additional amendments.
Ike Leggett is not running for re-election. There'll be a race next year for the county executive.
Yes.
Who are the candidates that you think you would support and maybe would sign such a bill?
I have not decided who I will be supporting.
You know,
I'm
asking for names here today.
Ask if you were running.
Well,
I know he knows that I'm not running.
Right.
I don't know, but you know, but it is a very important consideration for someone running in a Democratic primary and not support, you know, raising the minimum wage or not working towards figuring out a way to get there. Given some of the challenges that we have in a jurisdiction like Montgomery County, where the cost of living is so high. And, you know, this was gradual. I mean, this was a big impact right away. This was gradual. We worked, you know, to define small businesses. And, I mean, there was a lot of carve-outs. But I think if I were running for county executive, you know, I would be very mindful of these types of...
Afraid that's all the time we have. Nancy Navarro is a member of the Montgomery County Council. She's a Democrat representing District 4. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You didn't ask her about Tom Perez.
That's it for the show today.
But
we've always got more going on at our website where you can check out our show's entire archive. There's a lot of great content there for Black History Month, including a segment we did this week with an author who explored the story of Ona Judge, a slave who escaped from her owner, Martha Washington. Don't forget to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll explore what a green energy proposal could mean for Maryland now that it's survived the governor's veto and is on track to become law. We'll also talk with a former journalist who's using the power of reporting and storytelling to improve care for Alzheimer's patients. That's from noon till 1 Monday. Tom Sherwood, you have a great weekend. And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Namdi.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Timmy Olmsted. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.